Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, Massimo, in honor of the recent passing of the advice columnist Dear Abby, we've decided to make this episode of Rationally Speaking all about advice and advice columns.
Are we going to give any advice?
Are we going to give any advice? Yeah, I was planning on giving a lot of meta advice about how to give advice.
Excellent.
That was my plan. Right, so we were going to talk about how to give advice, how to take advice, like how to evaluate it, and also any ethical or philosophical issues involved in the advice column format and in the giving of advice in general. Sound good?
And all of that in less than 40 minutes.
Yeah, it's such a good deal, especially for your money.
Exactly. Okay, so what about Abby? You know that I didn't know much about her. You know, I'd heard about, of course, her column. I never read it, actually. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, we're talking big numbers here. Apparently, Dear Abby had, as a column, appeared in 1,400 newspapers worldwide with a daily readership of about 110 million people. And she received something along the orders of 10,000 letters and emails a week, which is just stunning if you think about it.
Wow.
It's an incredible reach. And before we get into the sort of the heavy philosophical or whatever it is, meta-advisical stuff, I actually wanted to, if you don't mind, to give a couple of quotes from Dear Abby, because
she's got some
really good ones.
A lot of bon mots, yeah.
Yeah, so for instance...
I wonder if yours overlap with my favorites.
Well, maybe. So there's two or three that I picked. So one is this. The letter said, Dear Abby, my wife sleeps in the raw.
Raw?
Yeah, so naked. This was some time ago. Then she showers, brushes her teeth, and fixes her breakfast. Still in the buff. We're newlyweds, and there are just the two of us, so I suppose that's really nothing wrong with it. But what do you think? Ed. And her reply was, Dear Ed, it's okay with me, but tell her to put an apron when she's frying bacon.
As someone who spent 3 weeks in the hospital because she was frying things while not wearing enough clothing, I can heartily second that advice.
All right. So here this is the second one. Dear Abby, are birth control pills deductible? Birdie. Dear Birdie, only if they don't work.
Yeah, I read that one too.
And okay, last one on my part. This is the letter. Dear Abby, two men who claim to be father and adopted son just bought an old mansion across the street and fixed it up. We notice a very suspicious mixture of company coming and going at all hours. Blacks, mm-hmm. whites, orientals, women who look like men and men
orientals.
Who look like women. Yeah. This has always been considered one of the finest sections of San Francisco, and these weirdos are giving it a bad name. How can we improve the neighborhood? Nobby Hill residents. Dear residents, you could move.
Yeah, that was also one of my favorites.
Anyway, so she was definitely something. There's no question about it.
I read that her politics evolved, I guess understandably, over the course of her advice giving, and that she became somewhat more progressive about issues like the acceptability of divorce and so on, right. Which is nice. I like when advice columnists change with the times.
Yeah. In fact, she's something interesting happened. You know, the advice columns have a long, very long history. For one thing, at least as far as I could dig out, the earliest column on record, advice column on record, was published in the Athenian Mercury in 1691.
I know. I was just poring over some of the old letters to the Athenian Mercury. They're delightful.
They are delightful.
I kept double-checking to make sure they weren't hoaxes, or to make sure this entire story wasn't an urban legend or a hoax or a satire or something, because they just seemed so too perfectly quaint.
Yes.
And yet at the same time modern. Like someone took modern letters and rewrote them in ye old quaint English or something.
Yeah. And they were, of course, from the beginning about, you know, things like essentially manners and, you know, issues of sort of social behaviors, like, you know, could an unmarried couple live together? That was one from the Athenian Mercury. But what I was going to point out, actually, is that you're right, that not only D.R. Abbey's own sort of views of life and politics and all that evolved, but in fact, the idea of advice columns itself evolved, obviously, since the 17th century. And one particularly sharp transition, apparently, happened right before with Dear Abby herself, essentially. A very famous advice column before her was by a woman whose pen name was Dorothy Dix, and whose real name was Elizabeth Gilmer, I think. And she published this column between 1896 and 1950 among other places, the New York Journal. And when there was a transition between these early part of the 20th century columns and Dear Abby, the type of problems, questions that people posed changed dramatically. I mean, we went from intimate, familiar things in a family setting, and mostly questions about manners or what to do under this or that circumstance, to really serious stuff. Like, a lot of the readers of Dear Abby had their children who, came out of the closet as gay. There was divorce all over the place. And so Dear Abby really found herself in the interesting situation of sort of dramatically changing times. So I'm not surprised that her views changed also significantly over the years in the response to a different social environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Athenian Mercury, which, yes, was the first advice column back from 1691 to, I think, 1697, seemed more like a cross between an advice or etiquette column and a scientific curiosity about the universe column. Article I was reading compared it to a cross between Dear Abby and Straight Dope, which is Cecil Adams' column, answering people's curiosities about how things work and so on. And some of my favorite queries to the Athenian Mercury were of the how does the world work sort. For example, where had Adam and Eve their needles and thread to sew their fig leaves together?
That's a good question. I always wondered about that.
You're not alone. Various people during the Restoration shared your same question. Why looking against the sun causes sneezing? What is the strongest creature in the universe, given its bulk? And my current favorite, why should the putting of a man's hand in cold water occasion a sudden emission of urine, notwithstanding his being fast asleep?
Wow. And yeah. That's a pretty cryptic.
Here's another one of my favorites from the Athenian Mercury, which falls under the category of, let me tell you about a problem a friend of mine is having. Question. I knew a gentlewoman who wept the first night she slept with her husband. Whether it was joy, fear, or modesty that caused these tears. This totally happened to a friend of mine.
Wow. And so what was the sort of advice given in response to these things? Several of the things you mentioned actually, well, maybe not specifically the ones you mentioned, but are the kinds of things that today we would just look it up on Wikipedia, right? If you want basic information about certain facts about the world, that pretty much you look it up at this point. But when it comes to advice on how to behave or how to, what to do in certain situations, then of course that's a little more difficult than you really are asking for advice. Although, even though the whole genre is usually referred to as advice columns, I was reading an article preparing for this podcast about a much more recent current column. The column is called Dear Sugar, and it's written by Cheryl Strait. And apparently, the idea here is that the author doesn't really give advice as much as essentially empathy. So that the basic point of the column is that, okay, these people are sharing things with you, and you're telling them, yeah, I know these things happen. It's more of a psychological support than actual advice on how to do things. And apparently, it's very successful. It's very popular, so I wonder if that also hasn't changed or is not changing as from as people can look up stuff, factual things, very easily, much more easily than any other time before in human history. Then perhaps the thing that it's harder to find, on the other hand, instead of a sort of actual practical advice, is just somebody who listens to you and somebody who says, yeah, I've been there, or I feel your pain and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I assume people who write letters to advice columnists must be, to some extent, choosing the kind of reaction that they want, right? So people who write into, say, Dan Savage they must know if they ever read his column that they're going to be getting a harder line from him. He's going to be more likely to tell the writer to dump their current paramour or to, I don't know, insist that their current mate be more good giving in game or something like that.
Right.
Whereas writing to Carrie Tennis, for example, you're going to get 2 pages of long pseudo-philosophical ramblings, and maybe that's what you want.
Right.
It seems to be pretty popular.
Right.
Or, you know, you write to Dear Sugar and you want empathy and you're not alone.
And of course, there's also the other thing that to keep in mind that is a comment that I read several times about from people who write about advice columns, and that is, you always have to remember that the set of people who actually write to advice columnists, of course, have at the very least a large enough ego to think that their problems, their private problems, are actually good enough for, or interesting enough for public, consumption, or perhaps they simply have the kind of personality that likes to be put out there, even though most of these columns, actually the letters are the authors
anonymous.
Of the letters are anonymous, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, the set of letters that we see is relatively chosen for interestingness. So I assume that advice columnists get a lot of letters from people that are not as interesting as the ones that we see.
That's true, yeah. That's,
and yeah, I mean, yeah. I was thinking about
the sampling effect. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about where the bias, the selection effect, or where sort of sampling bias comes into the advice column issue. And I don't know that it would come into the nature of the advice that the columnist would give to a particular letter, although, of course, every columnist has their own particular biases about, morals or human psychology. But it would mainly come in, I guess, from the perspective of the reader, who's maybe thinking of these letters as some kind of representative sample of the kinds of problems people have, and is not consciously thinking of the fact that they were chosen for interestingness or chosen because there was sort of a clear answer to give or something like that. Like, those would be the selection effects that would determine which letters we see.
Right. And actually, now that you mention it, that sort of selection effect, of course, is true for media in general. I mean, not just
sure.
for advice columns, right? I mean, if you watch the evening news or read the newspapers, you would think that the world is on fire every minute. It's probably not true. It's just that if what's interesting to people, what makes news is in fact the anomalous, the violent or the controversial.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have a newspaper lasting a second if they were publishing a bunch of boring stories about today was another nice day in the town and everybody got along together pretty much and 99% of people nothing happened. Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry. Were we recording a podcast?
Precisely.
Actually, you know what? I just thought of one potential source of probably slight bias that could creep into the columnist's advice that she or he chooses to give, which is the bias towards cleverness or pithiness or wit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were
yeah.
just talking about how Dear Abby was celebrated for her witty bon mots, and I could imagine that if a clever answer occurs to you, you would be biased towards choosing that answer rather than choosing a somewhat more nuanced and practical answer that has less wit. Like,
right.
One of the things you named a couple of things that were on my list of favorite Dear Abby bon mots, but one that you didn't mention was to a woman who wrote in asking about, my husband for years has had this wandering eye. He like keeps chasing skirts even though we've been married for so long. How can I cure this problem? And Dear Abby responded, rigor mortis, which is very funny, and may in fact reflect her opinion that such a man is never going to change.
Right.
But if she had believed that there was the potential for change or that there was something the woman could do to feel better at the situation, I could see how she would be biased against saying that instead, because that would mean passing up the chance for such a witticism.
Sure. Right.
Oh,
no,
also, sorry, last point on this topic. People are biased towards believing things that sound pithy or that rhyme, as one study found.
Ah, interesting.
Right.
That rhyme, huh?
Yes.
Interesting. I never particularly appreciate rhymes. So that's interesting to me. That's surprising.
Just sort of idioms like birds of a feather flock together.
That sort of thing. Right. Yeah. Which, of course, there's no particular reason to believe other than somebody was clever enough to put together the rhyme.
But, right. Yeah. Well, the study in particular that found this result tried coming up with non-rhyming versions of the idioms that preserved the meaning but altered the whether it rhymes or not. Yeah. Although, now that I'm recalling this, the study was a little shaky on methodology-wise, so add a grain of salt to what I just said.
Okay. One thing that I wanted to point out is that, you know, it's interesting to me that the advice column is actually surviving to the age of the internet.
I was thinking about that too.
But perhaps that actually is somewhat less hard to understand if you actually realize that apparently, for instance, in the case of Dear Abby, it wasn't just readers writing to her and, you know, her picking stuff and answering, and that was it. Apparently, what many newspapers allowed was sort of these follow-up by other readers that sort of would chime in over, and this would turn into, and she would answer back again. And so some of these threads would actually run for weeks and weeks and weeks, during which a good number of people would actually get their turn and saying their opinion. So that isn't really that much different. It's certainly a forerunner of, let's say, a blog with a comments section where people can keep going for, you know, sometimes months, in fact, after the original piece was published. So obviously, the time frame is very different, clearly, if we're talking about a printed newspaper as opposed to, say, a blog. But the basic idea is there. And so I'm assuming, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm assuming that actually there is quite a bit of advice columns on the internet at this point, as opposed to meaning that they're migrating to a web-based platform. Newspapers themselves are doing that. So I suppose that's not particularly surprising.
Yeah, I guess I'm less surprised by the public's appetite for reading advice columns than I am for the steady supply of people interested in writing into advice columns, especially given how unlikely it is that your letter is going to get picked.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Are there any advice columns for skeptics? Because I couldn't
find
any.
That's a good question. What kind of advice were you imagining people seeking in a skeptic advice column?
Well, I don't know. So for one thing, first of all, it seems to me that maybe we should start one. But second of all, but first let's decide on what kind of advice we're gonna give. So on the one hand, I don't see why, you know, people who think of themselves as skeptic, humanist, atheist, whatever it is, wouldn't have the same kind of problems, pretty much. That everybody else does, right? So issues in terms of sort of relationships or at work or, you know, how to behave in certain situations and all that. But of course, from a rationalist or humanist or atheist perspective. And so that for these kind of people, you know, sort of standard advice column might not work depending on the point of view and, you know, sort of background beliefs of the person who writes the column. So I don't know. That could be one thing. Or, of course, one could imagine a much more specific advice column for skeptics on, you know, how to deal with cognitive biases or something like that. Although that sort of thing is probably already covered, actually, not as an advice, directly as advice, but simply, you know, when people write blogs or columns for things like Skeptical Inquiry, that's pretty much what they write about. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think the new value added would be in the advice that doesn't fall into the kinds of, I was going to say mystical, but I don't mean in the pseudo-scientific way. I just mean in the sort of fuzzy thinking way
exactly.
that often happens when people give advice, like everything works out in the end, or, you know, there's someone out there who you're meant for. Those kinds of things tend to crop up when people give advice. And so maybe a skeptic or rationalist advice column would...
I mean, this is outside of the main topic for today, but this does remind me of, online dating sites. There are a few there are a few that are actually specific for, you know, skeptic, atheist, and so on and so forth. But they're remarkably few and not particularly well populated, I know because from first person experience.
what are they called? I'm not sure I've heard these.
Actually, I don't even remember, but I know that there are several actually, but they're all very very small populations, which of course in that kind of particular game means trouble.
Well, you can kind of create your own on sites like OkCupid, yes, by, you know, setting a really high filter. Like you can answer questions on OkCupid about religion or science, etc.,
right,
and set it so that you don't receive messages from anyone who answers sufficiently differently, right, from you, and then do only keyword searches for things like Feynman or, you know, right, skeptic, whatever.
It should be obvious to the listeners at this point that we both have used OkCupid. But that's not how we met, right?
Oh, we should do an episode on OkCupid.
We probably should, because they actually have a lot of data. As you know, they have a lot of data on their population.
Yeah, they do. And I have my issues with some of the statistical analyses they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of interesting ethical issues there, too. Anyway, yeah.
Anyway, close parenthesis on dating for a while. And let's go back to advice columns. So there are some advice columns that are actually much more specific than Dear Abby. For instance, there is a good number of advice columns that deal only and exclusively with medical advice. And those are actually interesting. I looked a little bit into those. And they're interesting because on the one hand, and we're talking about columns written by actual doctors, you know, not Dr. Oz or Dr. Phil, but, you know, professional medical professionals. Mm-hmm. And with, you know, presumably a better reputation than the two that I just mentioned. But the problem is, so on the one hand, these can be seen as good things because, quite frankly, just like we can use better scientific literacy in the population, we can certainly use better medical literacy. You know, a lot, mm-hmm, of people tend to have very similar problems. And so having a professional writing for, you know, briefly and to the point and clearly for the public, it's a good thing. But of course, that raises the issue of, well, how accurate are is this advice? Which in the case of medical advice is particularly important because, of course, people can act on that advice and get into, you know, serious health problems. So it turns out that there are some studies about this thing, this aspect. For instance, there's a study published a number of years ago now by Canadian researchers entitled Assessing the Quality of Newspaper Medical Advice Columns for Elderly Readers. So they focused specifically on geriatric problems. And the results, frankly, are not that good, as it turns out. So first of all, I find interesting the way in which they did the study. So they tabulated a bunch of advice given by in a number of newspapers by a number of medical practitioners. And then they asked a panel of independent experts, also medical practitioners, to rate that advice independently. So the panel was, each member of the panel was doing the ratings independently. Then they brought them together and they calculated basically an index of congruity, of agreement between the different responses of the panel. And what they did is that in several cases, they found a pretty good degree of agreement. When they did not, they employed a technique that I was not aware of, actually. It's called the Delphi process.
Hmm.
And the Delphi process consists in this. So you explain now at this point to the panel that, look, there's actually something, you know, you guys disagreed on this particular column, let's say. So you give them a second chance to reread the column and give a separate assessment.
Mm-hmm.
If the level of agreement has not changed significantly, it's not gone up, then what you allow is now a 5-minute open discussion about the content, but it's timed. So it's a very short discussion on the content of the column, after which you ask the panel to rate the object once again. And finally, you calculate the final agreement. And whatever you get at that point is what goes. If the disagreement remains, then it remains. Apparently, the Delphi process, this is called the Delphi process, and the Delphi process apparently is very popular when it comes to panels of experts. And it very often does yield good results. There is an increase in consensus if the experts can actually exchange their ideas. And it tends to make, in the case in which has been applied to the prediction of things, as opposed to like in this case that we're talking about, to sort of a simple ranking of advice that was given. It actually gives yields predictions that are comparable, if not better, to those that you get from markets, a market approach to predictions, which is something that we already talked also in on the show.
Crowdsourcing.
So yeah, I found it was interesting. So this thing called the Delphi process. Anyway, the results of this particular study were not particularly encouraging for the idea of medical advice columns. They found, and I'm quoting from the paper now, that in how well fact could be differentiated from opinion, 84% of the articles were either potentially unclear or misleading, 84%, and a total of 58% of the articles were found to provide unsafe or potentially dangerous advice.
Oh dear!
Yeah, that's
first
definitely
do no
not
harm.
Good. Exactly, first do no harm. So in other words, first shut up in this case. So that's the sort of thing that people might want to be aware of. That if you read these kind of things, and we're talking about not sort of soft psychological advice here. We're talking about actual advice on procedures and problems for in this particular case the geriatric population. So that was definitely not good.
So now that we've gotten onto the subject of evaluating advice or how to make sure you're getting good advice, I will mention that I actually teach a class on evaluating advice at the Center for Applied Rationality workshops that I help run. So I am kind of a meta advice giver.
And what do you
advice on advice? And well, I wanted to share a couple techniques that I use to make myself better at deciding how much to update my own opinions in response to hearing other people's opinions or other people's advice that they give me. And one technique I use all the time is just called the outside view. So I just ask myself, what would an outside party, like a third party, who would the outside party think was more likely to be right about this question that we disagree about, me or, my friend, based on our backgrounds, any relevant expertise or experience we have, and just our general reasoning and judgment ability. So, for example, last spring, when my organization was preparing to run its very first workshop, I had a disagreement with my co-founder, Anna, about whether we could possibly be ready to run a workshop in only 6 weeks. My inside view, just based on the evidence that I had at my disposal about, how well our past test sessions had gone and how much time I thought it would take to do all the tasks we would need to do in 6 weeks, like marketing and logistics, etc., was that there was no way we could be ready in 6 weeks. This seemed pretty clear to me. But Anna disagreed. She thought we could be ready, and, she had access to the same evidence that I did. Outside view, she was at least as good of a reasoner as I was. She had no less experience than I did with business or nonprofits. And the only difference between our relevant experience was that she had run a workshop the year before that was sort of an informal version of the workshop we were going to run. And she had not had very much time preparing, and it had gone well. And then there was the fact that we each had sort of an inchoate mass of intuition built up from the experiences that we'd had over the course of our respective lives, right, just getting to model how humans work and what they're likely to like and so on. And that's hard to share because it's not explicitly, in your brain as something shareable. But outside view, again, there was no reason to think that her experience that was causing her intuitions was less relevant than the experience that was causing my intuitions. So I grudgingly overruled my inside view, and we scheduled a workshop, and it went really well.
So she was
right. You shouldn't update too much on the one instance, since we could have gotten lucky. But that's the kind of way
it's a sample
view.
Size of one. No, but
it's totally true.
Yeah, but the technique that you use that you mentioned actually is similar, or it's probably, in fact, pretty much the same thing. There's an entire area of sort of epistemology that deals with epistemic humility. And so in that area, one of the things that that people often agree on in sort of philosophical circles is that if somebody who is comparably smart or credentialed than you,
your epistemic
peer raises a question of about whatever it is that you just propose or you're thinking, that in and of itself is a good reason to stop and ponder whether they're, in other words, to take it seriously. just because it comes from an epistemic peer. Now, of course, it could be that one or the other is wrong. It could be actually that both of them are wrong. I mean, there's no, in your case, you couldn't. There were only two possible outcomes: either you the thing went well or not. But in many cases, there's multiple outcomes, including the possibility that both individuals are actually wrong. But the idea basically is that it is a good epistemic practice, and you know, it's a matter of epistemic humility that as soon as somebody of equivalent roughly equivalent epistemic credentials raises a question, that in and of itself, regardless of what the context of the question is and the content of the question is reason enough to sort of to stop and take a breath, basically.
And that's reasonable. You know, to some extent, this technique helps guard against the tendency, which I think most of us have, to privilege our own impression just because it's our own, as opposed to because we have special expertise or, you know, knowledge about the issue.
Right.
But I should also note that it helps me avoid a different failure mode that I often have, which is underprivileging my own opinion. So
I never
like, for example,
that one.
Will you said you never have that?
I never have that one.
Yeah, I could have told our, I think our listeners know that. But I, on the other hand, sometimes will find myself, for example, in a meeting, will be disagreeing about how much money to ask a prospective donor for. Someone will throw out a number and I'll be internally surprised because I had thought we should ask for a different number. And I'll just sort of automatically assume that I should discount my own opinion and assume that I must be wrong since they disagree with me. And then if I remember, I take outside view and notice, hey, they don't have any more experience on this topic than I do. And, you know, their reasoning, I have no reason to think their reasoning would be better about this issue than mine. So there's no reason to underweight my opinion so much more than theirs.
Yeah. No, that's so, so those are interesting ways of thinking. Now that, again, there is a broader perspective there one can take. For instance, I think I mentioned a couple of times before on the show, but what you're talking about reminds me a lot of Ellen Longino's idea of how philosophy in general, philosophy of science, but I'm sorry, not philosophy of science, science in general should work. Mm-hmm. That is, by bringing in as many perspectives as possible, particularly including, you know, different ethnic backgrounds, obviously different genders and so on. The reason for that is because the more you do that, the more you have a serious, you know, a significant challenge to your perspective. If you stack your group, your peer group with people who already are very likely to agree with you, because they have similar life experiences, they have similar views of the world and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. then you sort of inflate artificially the level of agreement that you're going to get from your group. So that basically that turns into an epistemic argument for diversity within a particular group of, you know, in this case, in the case of Ellen Longino's, a group of scientists. But I assume that that works for pretty much any situation where you have to make a decision based on incomplete evidence and on human judgment, which is essentially every situation, really.
Yeah. And then the interesting hairy questions come in when you start deciding, well, surely not all kinds of intellectual diversity are valuable, right? Like,
no,
do you really want to have people on your board of advisors who think that faith is just as valid of a way of reaching conclusions as you know, empiricism?
That's right.
And there are some extremists, you could call them, in this philosophical field of epistemic disagreement, who would argue that, well, yes, of course you think that reason is a better method of reaching truth than faith, but they think that you're just as wrong as you think they're wrong, and you know, you have no cause to value your
opinion. It's interesting you mention that, because actually Longino's more recent book on the same topic actually raises exactly that question. That is, in fact, the way she approaches it is by essentially stipulating, not by fiat, but by argument, that there are some values that are in fact bad, and therefore that proponents of those values in the case of your example, somebody would say, you know, well, reason, forget reason. Well, that's a bad value, so you do exclude it from the conversation, because after all, in order to have a conversation, you have to share a certain amount of background, because otherwise you're playing what Wittgenstein would refer to as a different language game. Or in other words, you're not talking about the same thing, or you're not approaching, your approaches become essentially incommensurable. So you're right. It's a difficult balancing act between increasing sort of diversity of opinion But at the same time, you don't want to increase that diversity so much so that then you get all sorts of random or positively negative and hurting opinions. Now,
right.
Since we're talking about philosophy, I actually have I'm curious, and I have a quiz for you, if you don't mm-hmm. mind. So one of the advice columns that I looked into is the New York Times ethicist column.
Aha, yes. I was wondering if we were going to yes, get around to
which
him.
Has a long history, and you know, it's been actually written by different people. It's not always the same person. The current
author... It's not been Randy Cohen?
No, the current author is Chuck Klosterman. And
this
changed recently, actually, I think about a year ago. At any rate, so I read one column in particular recently that had an interest. This was January 22nd, 2013, and it was interesting. And so I have my opinions about how he responded, but I wanted first to hear your take on it. The question was about somebody who says, you know, my mother is an MD and who now practices alternative medicine and is anti-vaccine. And so mm-hmm. this person grows up as an anti-vaccine, alternative medicine kind of person. And now, however, so he says, you know, like a kid in inheriting his parents' faith, I grew up with a strong sense of that value system. So, question, am I ethically obligated to get a flu shot when you know, when he goes to work? Besides, he goes in restaurants. He worked in an open air office, eats in crowded restaurants, and takes the subway. So, in other words, all situations where you could have, in fact, you could communicate a flu. Now, mm-hmm. Klosterman's response, so the New York Times ethicist's response, I won't read it in its entirety, but it goes along these lines. It says, "Well, should you get a flu shot? Yes. It's more socially responsible and thus more ethical relative to doing the opposite. But are you obligated to get a flu shot? You are not. And the reason he says you're not is because your question involves a potentiality. It is certainly possible that not getting a flu shot could affect other people, but that possibility is not even close to absolute. And it's just not reasonable to make every personal decision based on what might theoretically happen to a stranger."
So, you could say that about drunk driving, too.
Right,
you might not hit someone.
Right, exactly. Thank you. So that was my response to it. I said, no, wait a minute. This makes no sense. So we should fire the ethicist at the New York Times. I think the two of us should apply for the position of ethicist at the New York Times.
That's...
In fact, I hereby put out to the New York
Times...
I'm sorry,
I'm not sputtering at your suggestion. I'm still sputtering at the answer to the letter.
Yeah. Right.
There were a bunch of things that sort of rubbed me the wrong way about some of the ethicist columns that I read. For the most part, they fell under the category of just not being particularly philosophically sound. Like, he would sort of assert something that, I don't know, maybe sounded like a deontological bit of, or that it was, you know, grounded deontologically,
right.
But not consequentially. And he just sort of left it as self-evident that, of course, you would, you know, you should be a deontologist instead of a consequentialist. Right. I mean, he wouldn't use those words,
but it's a very
unsettled question whether
one is a better framework than the other.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Or whether you have any cause to prioritize one set of ethics than others.
Yeah, there's one thing that I do like about the column, and that is the idea that we can have reasoned discussion about ethics, right? So, for instance, even in the case that I just read, where we both disagree with the ethicist advice, however, he does actually go into some detail and explains why he thinks that there is a difference between whether one should get the flu, his answer again is yes, or whether one is obligated to get the flu, and his answer is no. Now, we obviously disagree with his second answer, but first of all, it's interesting that he does make that distinction, which in other contexts is relevant, between, you know, should you do something, and, you know, is it a good idea in general, or as opposed to being obligated to do something, morally speaking. But more importantly, I think it gives the reasons. And so you can actually go and read the column and say, no, wait a minute, I disagree with it, and here's why. And to me, that is the value of ethical reasonings to begin with. Regardless of the particular framework in ethics that you happen to adopt, I mean, the point of ethical reasoning is, in fact, that it is a type of reasoning, meaning that you're supposed to be giving reasons for why you do or you do not do, or you ought to do or shouldn't do a certain thing. Because once those reasons are out, then they're part of the public discourse. And somebody can come in and say, no, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense because, and then you go on and explain why it makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that at the very least, the ethicist is providing more things to consider or a framework in which to think about it, yeah. So that even if you don't think his answer is valid, you've at least got more things to chew on.
Right.
It's kind of a weak, I don't know, I think an ethicist could do better than that.
Well,
but
should an ethicist do that, or ought an ethicist to do better than that?
Oh my God.
I think it ought to.
I actually had one other bit of meta advice that I wanted to get in here,
Sure. Advice
on getting advice, which I've been implementing more and more myself. And that is that I try harder now to avoid contaminating the advice that I get by inadvertently asking leading questions. Uh-huh. And when I started paying attention, I noticed that I did this all the time, just without thinking about it. I would ask someone, you know, do you think that this title is too silly? I'm concerned this is too silly. Do you think it is?
Yeah.
You know, so I've already told them what I think the answer is, and I'm just asking if they agree.
As opposed to, what do you think of this
title? What do you
title?
Think of this
right.
title,
exactly.
Right?
Right, yeah. No, that's.
Or what else do I do? Sometimes I inadvertently anchor people on one number. So, for example, you might think that asking the question, do you think that I need more or less than 3 hours' time to prep for this meeting, might be good because you're not prioritizing more or less the way you're prioritizing silly in the first example.
Right.
But actually, you're anchoring them on one number. And
right.
as you probably know, people are...
Yeah,
right. So maybe
10.
They had originally thought that you know, barely needed to prepare at all. But since you've asked them the question using 3 hours as the anchor, now suddenly they're more inclined to say, yeah, maybe you do need longer to prep than I had originally thought.
Yeah.
And then the last way in which I noticed myself biasing the advice I got was that when I would describe a disagreement I'd had with someone, like let's say I'm telling my best friend I had this disagreement with my coworker, and he said this and I said that, and who do you think was right? I've already told him who said what, right?
That's
and
right.
So
exactly.
If he's biased towards agreeing with me, either because he likes me more or because he just in general thinks I tend to be right more, then, you know, I'm not getting a clean answer from him about which point of view he thinks is right. So I just anonymize it now.
That's right. Yeah,
I'll
that's
just
the
say,
same,
like, these two arguments, which do you lean towards?
Yeah, that's the same principle essentially behind blind peer review, that, you know, you don't want the reviewer to know who the author is, because otherwise that author may have a either a personal connection, of course, but also simply a matter of reputation. And that
right,
reputation or connection can bias the outcome. Yep.
Yep. Well, we're almost out of time for this part of the episode. But before we wrap up, Massimo, do you have any examples of terrible advice that you came across in your search? Because I've got a couple.
Terrible advice. You mean other than the not taking the flu shot?
Oh, right. And,
that was
you know,
pretty bad, I thought.
That is pretty bad.
Other than
right.
that, I'll leave it to you to give us an example or two.
Well, I saved this one. This is from Brides Magazine. Someone wrote in to ask.
Oh, one of my favorite. I'm sorry.
Yes. I know. You've been dreaming about it since you were a little girl.
Exactly.
One of my bridesmaids, the letter writer wrote, is constantly complaining about how much she hates the dress. While all the others like it, what should I do? And the columnist wrote back, take her aside and ask what is really bothering her. Is it the dress? Is it the price? Is it her weight? Is it something about her being single? So basically the advice here was, if your friend doesn't like the bridesmaid dress, which you're forcing her to buy for several hundred dollars, take her aside and ask her if maybe the real problem isn't just that
That's
she's
right.
fat and lonely.
The problem is
That's definitely going to work.
Wow.
All right. On that strong advice note, we will wrap up this section of the podcast and move on to the Rationally Speaking picks. I'd like to take this moment to remind our listeners that if you're a fan of the Rationally Speaking podcast, you'll definitely enjoy this year's Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, which will be held in New York, New York, the weekend of April 5th through 7th, 2013. Go to nexus.org now to get your tickets. They're on sale. In addition to Massimo and I, you'll also find a lineup of great speakers, including the SGU, Simon Singh, Michael Shermer, and our keynote speaker, physicist Leonard Mlodinow, author of The Drunkard's Walk. Nexus.org, that's NECSS.org. Go get your tickets now.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is actually an anti-pick, which I don't do nearly as often as I would have expected myself to, given all of the things that irritate me in the world. So this time I'm actually going to act on that. It's a movie, which many of our listeners may have already seen, and I am a little late to the party, but Cloud Atlas came out
late
2012. Yep. And I had kind of mixed feelings about it as a movie overall, but the reason in particular that I want to complain about it as my anti-pick was this line towards the end of the movie from the niece of the scientist character who worked at the nuclear power plant. She says, "My father may have been a scientist, but still, he believed love was real."
Ooh.
Yeah.
You mean scientists can actually believe that? And it's a contradiction, clearly, being a scientist and believe that.
Yeah. So this line made me think that maybe we should have an award called the Straw Vulcan Award that we give to movies or TV shows or books that so perfectly embody this archetype of the Straw Vulcan, which sets rationality and logic and science as opposed to things like love and compassion and beauty.
Yep. Okay.
And Cloud Atlas would be my nominee for such an award.
Should we make it an annual award?
I think so. I think Cloud Atlas might win for 2012, actually. But 2013 is still up in the air. So, you know, start your motors, everyone.
Sounds good.
Well, what's your pick?
Just by coincidence, I also have an anti-pick.
You're kidding. This has never happened before.
Never happened before. In fact, I think this is my first anti-pick, but I might get used to it.
So maybe we're both just extra curmudgeonly this week.
That's very possible. This is an article, a long article, actually, that we'll link to on the website by Daniel Tutt, T-U-T-T, on atheism. But in particular, although the title is sort of generic, as in atheism, that's the title, the article is actually about how continental philosophers think about atheism. And, you know, continental philosophy, we've talked about it in the past, is sort of that branch of modern philosophy that is very distinct from what most people think of as philosophy. That is, instead of using sort of rational arguments and, you know, the formal deployment of logic and that sort of stuff, it's really more written as a sort of an essay style thing. And and it deals with typically more political or social issues than sort of standard analytic philosophy and that sort of stuff. And there's quite a bit to be said for that approach. I'm not trying to diss continental philosophy in general here, but a subset of continental philosophy is the kind of postmodernist deconstructionist stuff that was famously attacked by physicist Alan Sokol in what has become known as the Sokol hoax a number of years ago, when he wrote a paper called entitled something about the hermeneutics of quantum mechanics or some quantum gravity or something like that, where he basically wrote a very, very long paper that was nonsensical on purpose, submitted it to Social Text, which is a postmodern continental philosophy journal, and then the editors accepted it for publication, and after which Sokol exposed them, basically saying, you know, you guys have no idea what the heck you're talking about, because clearly you couldn't recognize that this is an hoax. Now, why am I telling you this? Because this article reads like something written by Alan Sokol, but it's not. It's meant seriously.
And it's about atheism?
It's about atheism. And so just to give you a little bit of, you know, sort of an idea of what I'm talking about, here it is. Unlike Badiou and Melasseau, Nancy's ethics is grounded in a demand from an other, with a capital O, what he calls l'adoration. This demand serves as the fundamental origin of all ethics and alterity. I don't know what alterity means. But it is different than Levinas' proto-theological absolute alterity. Ethics, in this vein, is a behavior that is on the same place as ontology, and it starts with a free decision to receive oneself. Ethics is a moment that occurs when one holds oneself as a decision, whereby the law recedes, leaving being open by freedom, and the subject arrives at singular plural being. Now, if you understood the hell that means, I'll be happy if you explain it to me.
Yeah, I don't understand what's so confusing about that, Asura. It seemed pretty clear to me.
And it's not that it's not clear because this is technical jargon. I mean, to some extent it is, because some of the words that the author is using here are, you know, sort of technical within the tradition of contemporary continental philosophy. But it's obscure because it really is obscure. It's not clear at all if it says anything that is in fact meaningful or can be unpacked in any way. So if our listeners want a good idea of what a real as opposed to a hoax or pretending piece of baloney in continental philosophy looks like, well, by all means, download this article and enjoy.
Wow, I think we should have anti-picks more often, Massimo. It's surprisingly cathartic. Well, it's been a great episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.